Hi, I'm Michael Senoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
The ultimate way to be buzzworthy is to be absolutely excellent at what you do. And that is the single most important thing I can tell you about your business. Because the long-term great business successes have all started out by focusing on great products, on being excellent. Hands down, period, end of story.
Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. I'm pleased to bring you an exclusive interview for my HardToFindSeminars.com listeners, and it's with Mark Joyner. Mark Joyner's clients pay him thousands of dollars an hour for his time and expertise, and now is your chance to hear answers to questions from my subscribers. Mark Joyner is a number one best-selling author of over a dozen books translated in almost as many languages, including The Irresistible Offer and The Second Glass. He is widely recognized as one of the early pioneers of e-commerce, responsible for inventing, pioneering, and popularizing many of the technologies we take for granted today, including remotely hosted ad tracking, electronic books, and more. One of his books, Mind Control Marketing, shot to number one within 36 hours of its release. One of his websites became the 37th most visited website on the planet within 6 weeks of its release. His pioneering book, Search Engine Tactics, was downloaded over 1 million times years before ebooks were even common. He's turned a one-man operation into a multi-million dollar international corporation with customers in every internet-connected country on the planet in 2 years' time. In this exclusive interview, you'll hear Mark answer questions from my HardToFindSeminars.com listeners on subjects like marketing, publishing, search engine strategies, traffic secrets, and internet marketing. Mark currently lives with his fiance in Auckland, New Zealand, and it is my pleasure to introduce to you over an hour and a half of answers from this amazing man. Get ready, hang on tight, and let's get going. How did you fall into this whole internet marketing thing, and how long ago was it? How long have you been in this game?
I would say that my proper start was around 1994, and that was when e-commerce was just really taking off its shirt and getting ready to fight. Back then, it was what we call the Wild Wild Web days.
Where were you at that time?
It was while I was serving in Korea, while I was in military intelligence. That was in 1994. I did a bit of online marketing then, and as you know, back then, there wasn't really any online marketing theory. So what I did was I just started formulating my own theory out of what I knew about military strategy and psychology. And I remember there was a martial arts instructor of mine many, many years ago that said, you can apply anything that you learn from the martial arts metaphorically to anything else in life. I thought that that was just really profound, and I found that to be true. And I thought, well, here's this new internet marketing thing. Really, we weren't even calling it internet marketing back then. It was just sort of like, hey, we're on the internet, and people were farting around selling stuff. Very few people were, and there wasn't really any theory. You couldn't buy a book on how to market on the internet, how to do business on the internet back then. They simply didn't exist. So I thought, well, why don't I do that? Why don't I apply what I know about military strategy, specifically Asian military strategy and human psychology, doing business on the internet? Now, keep in mind, at the time, I didn't really know much about doing business at all. I'd always been very entrepreneurial since I was really, really young. But I didn't have any formal marketing training. I didn't have any formal business training at all. I just sort of went out there and started experimenting with stuff and figuring things out on my own. I did that for a while. In 1995, I went to officer candidate school, became a field artillery officer. By the way, most people back then didn't know I was in the Army. I kept that fact a secret. I didn't want people to know that I was kind of living a double life there.
How old are you now?
Right now, I'm 37. 95, after I got out of officer candidate school and started working with the field artillery there, I started looking at a few, you know, real marketers. So I guess that probably wasn't until about 96 or 97 when I did that. I was playing around a lot on my own and had some very good successes. You know, I had some websites out there that were extremely high traffic. I had what was the most popular personal development or self-improvement type website in existence back then. It was called Hot Rod Your Head. Looking back on it now, it was an absolutely terribly designed website, but lots of really interesting information. I just had a great time marketing it. I started to develop a reputation as an authority in building web traffic from building traffic to that website.
All right, let's talk about it. Was Hot Rod Your Head your first somewhat success, your first attempt at making money on the Internet?
That was my first real success. And frankly, the money I made from that wasn't really anything too significant compared to what I had done after that.
How did you know what to do to even get it started? What was your idea, Hot Rod Your Head? What was it?
Back then, it was just basically me wanting to talk about some ideas that were really important to me. But the topics were helping people discover what their real potential was, and not just in some superficial way like you hear about in a lot of these self-improvement products. Discover your full potential. A lot of it's just so much garbage and snake oil. I was asking, what can you really do? What are the limits of human potential physically? What can a person do? And these were the things that we were exploring. And the website was all about exploring that in a lot of different ways. And it was constantly morphing itself and changing. And we had a lot of really interesting people come and show up there. For example, this guy isn't a marketer in the traditional sense. He's marketed himself fairly well in the underground world. He's one of the people who's influenced my life the most. He was actually a columnist for the website. His name's Robert Anton Wilson. He wrote a series of books called The Illuminatus Trilogy, which was a huge cult-following book in the 60s and 70s. This guy talks about ideas that will literally blow your mind and change the way you perceive reality. And he was talking about things like general semantics, for example, that was one of the major influencers of neuro-linguistic programming long before these ideas became very popular. A lot of people don't know that NLP was greatly influenced by Ericksonian hypnotherapy and by general semantics and a few other topics. I would say maybe the vast majority of the ideas there, and not to poo-poo NLP at all, they've got some great ideas, and they've popularized a lot of great ideas, which were, of course, then popularized more by Tony Robbins than by NLP. But Robert Anton Wilson is really probably the first guy to popularize these types of topics. And a lot of the concepts that people are capitalizing on today would not have been real estate that could be capitalized on if he hadn't spearheaded that.
How did you make money with the site? Were you selling an information product? Did you do any audio on the site at that time, or what was the model on that?
There was a little bit of audio on the website. The model was basically I was selling a companion book, which was a course on how to increase your intelligence called Hot Rod Your Head, and then we developed a shopping mall for sort of alternative personal development type products called Potent Tools. Eventually, I sold both of those websites off to Learning Strategies Corporation. Those are the guys who the photo reading course, and they're doing completely different things with the domains now. I think they're just placeholders, more or less. So really, they're completely defunct. But somewhere along the way there, I started writing about Internet marketing sort of on the side. I wrote an electronic book called Search Engine Tactics, which a lot of people recognize as the first book about search engine marketing, and maybe even the first ebook. I don't know if that's true. I get credited with that a lot. Again, there may have been ebooks before that. I will take credit for popularizing the medium, though. I don't think there was any movement to popularize ebooks before that at all. And that book certainly was one of probably the driving force behind getting ebooks out there.
Was that the one that was downloaded like a million times?
It was downloaded over a million times by 1998, and then we stopped counting at that point. But yeah, it did very, very well. It's the only ebook ever to be given 5 stars by ZDNet. It was one of the top 100 downloads in 1999 on download.com. That's after we stopped counting it. So but it had a life for a while there. I don't think it even matters anymore now because the ideas are extremely out of date. But I didn't really get into real marketing until I met Joe Vitale. And Joe was the first real marketer that I met. He was the first real guy who had direct marketing experience.
How did you meet him?
Joe was actually introduced to me by a mutual friend of ours called Win Wenger. Win is a guy who wrote a book called The Einstein Factory. He co-authored it with a gentleman named Richard Poe. And Win is very well known for being rather eccentric with ideas on how to increase human intelligence. I think he's a visionary. He's got some great ideas. It just so happens that Joe and Win were friends, and then Win and I were talking about marketing. He said, well, you really need to talk to Joe Vitale. I purchased some of Joe's stuff, and I hadn't been exposed to any real marketing information before that. Joe is a guy who learned from the classic direct marketers. Very soon thereafter, I started pushing Joe to publish his stuff electronically. I said, let me take this old out-of-print manuscript you have called Hypnotic Writing, and let me turn it into an electronic book. It took me about 2 years to convince him to do it because he thought, who's going to buy an e-book, right? This is what everybody thought back then. Eventually, we published that, and we also ended up publishing a few of his videotapes. I think we may have been the first companies to electronically push and sell video and audio material as well.
Let me ask you this. A lot of these internet marketers, they're one-man shows. Did you have partners? What did your business look like at that time?
Well, the business was constantly morphing. For a while there, it was me as a one-man show. Depending on the different initiative that we had, there were different iterations of it. At some point, I created a few search engines. One of them we even sold off to a public company, and that was created with a partner of mine who lived in Australia. At the time, I was living in Oklahoma. Eventually, ESOP did morph into a formalized company. At our peak, we had 45 employees and overhead of $250,000 a month. So when I say we, I just kind of use that in a broad sense. I'm not an egotistical guy.
Yeah, I understand. The early days, was it you in your basement doing this? What did it look like?
It was me in my living room in Oklahoma. That was when I was really doing a lot of the work. A lot of people didn't realize that I looked like a much bigger operation way back then.
The early days, were they painful? What kind of screw-ups did you make? What were some of the learning curves? I'm sure you paid your dues like anyone else, right? Late nights, early mornings.
Oh, sure. I made screw-ups yesterday, and I certainly made a lot way back then as well. That's something that people need to realize. Probably the biggest and ugliest mistake I made was some trust I put into a public company. I won't say who or even hint at what it was. Back before the dot-com bubble burst, a lot of us were saying, and I was really trying to get this idea out there, that the dot-com world, as it was believed in the stock market at the time, was a world of smoke and mirrors. And people were thinking back then, well, hey, all you got to do is put up a flaming logo on a website and people will come. And it was like the Field of Dreams theory, you know, build it and they will come and all the venture capital you need will be there. And it was kind of like that to a certain extent because people were ignorant. And towards the end of that, I had some interaction with a public company and my instincts were that I shouldn't trust these guys. And it turned out that they were really complete con artists. I put my trust in them. I wanted them to float a business idea, and they ended up basically stealing all of our intellectual property. I hadn't really thought everything through as I should have. I trusted the contracts too much. I didn't trust my instincts enough. I just really learned to keep business as simple as possible. If I sense that things are getting too complicated or that the negotiations are getting paranoid or that I don't feel 100% comfortable about something, I'll just say, you know what, life's too short. Let's just move on to the next deal. And I think that in a global sense, that's something that we all have to do to protect ourselves. Whenever business gets complicated, that's when you start losing money.
Have you had any success in regular direct marketing, or has all of your success been in the internet marketing world?
Almost all of it's been in the internet marketing world, to be honest. I've done a bit of a testing with direct marketing stuff, and I've certainly consulted for a lot of people with their direct marketing campaigns and helped them boost their profitability, but I haven't been at the helm of any of that. I haven't been the CEO of a company that was based on direct marketing. But thank goodness, it's a lot lower risk on the internet. Mike, as you know, my God, what the old guys in direct marketing had to go through. You had to be really, really smart to get by in direct marketing and have a huge tolerance for risk And that's why you'll notice that the old classic direct marketing experts tend to be a bit tougher and a bit sharper than your average internet marketing expert, simply because you had to be better to be successful.
Here's a question from Chris. With regards to the quote, one of Mark's websites became the 37th most visited website on the planet within 6 weeks of its release, I have the following questions. Was that a fluke or was it intended? Did Mark actually intend to get in the top 50 or was it an unintended result? The other question was, if it was planned, what concepts would Mark advise others to adapt in their web promotion in order to have sure and similar results?
That is a very, very good question, and I'll tell you what my thinking was, what was good about that, and what the flaw was.
What project was this that he's speaking of?
This was called startblaze.com, which is now totally defunct. In fact, if you go to the domain, it'll just go to my new blog.
You're listening to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com.
It's really funny, though, because we still get traffic from people thinking it's Startblaze. Still to this day, a fairly decent amount of it. But that project was what a lot of people credit as being the first traffic exchange type website. Again, I don't know if that was really the first. I think that there were probably a bunch of us around that time that were starting to do that. Mm-hmm. The concept of exchanging traffic in that way was a new thing back then. And it was probably the most dramatically successful, that's for sure. But what prompted me to start that and prompted me to actually plan to be one of the top 100 websites, to answer that question, yes, I did definitely have that at the time. Two things happened. For that first, I went and I studied what some of the top 100 websites in the world were at the time, and I found that there were a couple out there that were advertising brokers. And I thought, wow, of course, that's so brilliant, because these guys have got their ads on all of these websites. That gets them that extra traffic and therefore that vote of confidence. So I looked at that and I thought, God, I mean, that's just so easy to have a high traffic website that way, but that's got to be meaningful. You have to take advantage of that high position for it to be meaningful, right? Because you can be number five in the world, and if nobody knows it, well, there's no advantage to really being number five except for the fact that you're getting all this traffic. And the ad brokers, in a sense, it's illusory because their ads are showing up on other people's websites. That may or may not be a profitable endeavor for them. Now, the other thing that I used to kind of put this together was we did a survey of our customers, and we had a massive customer base at the time because we had run several search engines and just did a number of things to get, I mean, at that point, you had millions of subscribers. We did a survey, and one of the questions we asked, and we asked this in many, many different ways, is what is your biggest problem? If we could wave a magic wand, what would be the problem we could solve for you right now? And over and over and over again, the word that kept coming up was traffic, visitors, traffic. I said, okay, well, we haven't really done a product targeted for that specific problem. So I put those ideas together. I thought about what the best way to do it would be, and I came up with the idea of this start page exchange. And what it was is, all you had to do was make Startblaze your start page, and other Startblaze members' ad would be shown on your site. So every time that you open up your start page, you'd be earning ad credits. And then on top of that, if you told other people, this is where the viral marketing aspect came in, if you told other people about it, then a fraction of the credits that they generate would be yours as well.
Had you already had your search engine company already? Had you had traffic already?
Yeah, by the time that was going, I had actually run several search engines. So that was one nice thing, is that we had a nice, warm crowd that was interested in getting traffic, and our data proved it. So putting all those things together, what our customers wanted, what the top 100 websites were at the time, what our base was, applying what I knew about viral marketing and viral system design, which is still a burgeoning industry. Really, people are just kind of waking up about that now. So putting all that together, we created that, and then just took off like gangbusters. And combined with that, we went out and we did an orchestrated product launch, which is something a lot of people are talking about on the internet now. The concept is really, really simple. You just go out and contact the right people who have got access to the right audience, motivate them to spread the word about what it is that you have, and they're going to go out and work like crazy for you because it's in their benefit to do so. In a general sense, that's really all you need to do to get good viral marketing started. and to get a good product launch going. Now, I've modified my thinking on that, but from a tactical sense, that's really all you need. Philosophically, I think there's a lot more you need, and that's what the last two books I wrote were all about.
Can you take me back, because this is really important, how do I get more traffic? And it seems like you came up with a solution, and that was create and control your own search engine. That's certainly a pretty good way to get traffic. How did that all start, and what was your strategy in starting your own search engines? Was that the ultimate goal?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't go out and suggest that to everyone.
Well, where you were at that time in your mind?
Well, where I was at that time was, hey, something I realized, I was looking back at the early gold rush days, and I wrote an article about this way back in 1995, and I made an observation saying that back in the gold rush days, the gold miners were rarely the ones who built lasting wealth. It was the people who were selling pickaxes and shovels to the miners that really made all the money. And since then, I think that was a metaphor that got picked up and used quite a bit about the Internet, and I think it was quite apt. And so I thought, well, why don't I become a purveyor of pickaxes and shovels? And by that time, I was selling electronic books and services and whatnot for Internet marketers. And what better way to get a warm market of Internet marketers than to be the one place where they absolutely have to be, which was in the search engine. Right now, I would say, look, you know, even though I'm the guy who wrote a book that a lot of people credit as the first book about search engine marketing, I don't even do much search engine marketing myself anymore. It's funny, just the last few weeks, I was looking at some SEO stuff, and I kind of had to re-educate myself about what was going on because I just haven't stayed up on it. Now I'm at a point where I can capitalize on it without having to do any extra work, very much against people going out and manipulating the search engines and doing a lot of fakey, snaky tactics to get the traffic that they want. But now I've got some organic things going on that can take advantage of that. But anyway, that was the thinking at the time. Now, what I like to tell people is, I talk about in my new book, The Great Formula, that I've got four overall strategies you can use to capture thirsty crowds. And really, I think any way that you can think of to bring traffic, which is another way of saying a thirsty crowd, will fall into these four categories. And if you grasp this, this will give you an overall way of looking at the world so you can see opportunities for doing this everywhere. And the four methods are, one, pay for access to a crowd. Two, you can speculate for access to a crowd. Three, you can manifest a crowd from thin air, which is what we did with the search engine, by the way. And four, you can find lost crowds. And if you start to look at the world in that way, then, wow, I mean, there's potential for traffic and for advertising eyeballs basically everywhere you turn.
Do you know of some good sources that one could buy decent traffic, or are you talking in reference to like joint ventures, or are there sources, you hear about these lead exchanges, but I don't have a very good opinion of them just from what I hear, but maybe I'm wrong. Do you know of any reputable sources that Internet marketers can buy genuine leads that are double opt-in that have a good potential of building a list or selling products?
I mean, frankly, my experience with that kind of thing isn't too good either. I haven't been able to generate an ROI from purchased leads like that for the most part. A couple of exceptions, but frankly, there's maybe one or two out there that I would use, but I would never say who they were. Why? Because then everyone's going to go out and use that source, and it's not going to be valuable anymore. So I would just tell people, look, it doesn't have to be that way. You can purchase traffic. You can generate traffic and generate your own leads. In fact, those leads are probably going to be a lot better. Why? Because you have control over the frame through which they initially opt into your list. What does that mean? Well, when you go through a co-reg, you've got somebody who's gone through a very detailed marketing process. They're thinking about one thing, and then all you are is this extra checkbox on that website. They're not going to remember you. They're going to remember that experience, and that experience is going to prep them for something that may or may not be conducive of them buying your product. So if you set up a landing page, a lot of people are calling it squeeze pages now, or an opt-in page that is specifically targeted towards the person who would be interested in your product, and then you drive the appropriate traffic to that page, who's going to be on your list? Well, if you phrase the copy on that page properly, the only people who are going to be on your list are people who are going to be interested in the other things that you have. Now, that's a big mistake a lot of people make. they create these landing pages, and the copy on there is solely designed to get people to opt in, but not to get them to opt in the right frame of mind, which is a total waste of time.
Give me an example of a wrong way and a right way. Can you?
Well, okay, I'll give you two really, really extreme examples just to drive the point home. Let's just pick a product out of thin air, Mike.
Trampolines.
Trampolines. Okay, you had some ad copy that said, Pamela Anderson bouncing naked on a trampoline. Opt into our list for a picture. And then you had another one that said, get our free report that shows you the five major health benefits of using a trampoline for exercise. Yeah, which opt-in is going to be more likely to buy your product?
Of course, the second one.
Obviously the second, right? You're going to get tons more of the first one, but the conversion is going to be so low from them that it won't even matter. In fact, it's going to be a waste of your time, because then when you send them your marketing materials, they're going to complain about you because you kind of broken their trust, right? You promised one thing and you delivered something else.
So we're talking about qualifying your leads. Get good qualified leads that fit what you're selling.
In a sense, that's the way of looking at it. There are so many levels and ways to qualify people. On the Internet, if we're talking about building that list, you want to qualify them for being an opt-in member of your list and not just cram as many names on there as you can.
Okay, good. There's a question on ebooks from Lorna in Canada. Mark, are ebooks really dead, or are they just taking a nap?
Well, I don't know if they're even really taking a nap. I would love to talk to Lorna and see where she's getting that information from. Have you seen some stats that show that ebook sales are going down?
No, I haven't.
I haven't either. You know, it's funny. People get perceptions from the strangest things. It's like they log into one of these bulletin boards, and some crank who doesn't know a dang thing and doesn't have a lick of sense says, ebooks are dead. Ebook sales have been down for the last 2 years, and everybody reads that and they go, oh, wow, that's true. It's not. So you got to be really careful about where you get your information from. Another thing is, no offense to Lorna, she just got bad information from somewhere. She could be making this assumption from her own sales, right? It could be that her own sales have gone down. And we can't be making what they call the post hoc ergo propter hoc error in logic. That's just a fancy way in Latin of saying after this, therefore, because of this. And it talks about the difference between causality and correlation. Just because there's a correlation between two events doesn't mean there's a causal link between the two. For example, it could be that in the last year, your sales for ebooks have gone down. You might assume then that because sales are going down everywhere, that in this last year sales have gone down, that is the cause of it. But there's really no real reason to believe that, because you don't have enough evidence. And this is a problem in science in general. It's very, very difficult to show a causal link between things. Another thing is what I like to call the myth of everyone. And I'll ask you this, Mike, you're an American guy. You've been in America most of your life. Is that right? Have you traveled much outside of the United States?
A little bit, but not too much. I've been here most of my life.
Do you know who Robbie Williams is? Not Robin Williams, the actor, but Robbie Williams, the singer.
Robbie Williams.
Never heard of him, right?
I don't think so.
That's okay. What about David Beckham? You know who he is?
David Beckham, yes, I know who he is.
Okay. Do you watch World Cup?
I don't, but I know he's a soccer player who dates Posh.
Yeah, yeah, from the Spice Girls. Now, you have to think a little bit about it, right? He's not exactly on the top of your mind, is he?
No, not
now,
normally.
Now, ask you who Shaq is. Do you know who he is?
Yes.
Yeah, you didn't even hesitate for that, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. David Beckham is the most widely known sports figure in the world. I'm surprised you even knew who he was. Most people in the United States don't even have the first clue who he is. Robbie Williams just so happens to be the best-selling artist in the world for music. In the United States, we don't have the first clue who he is. Now, I did this little demonstration. It's a seminar I was doing with Gary Halbert in Miami. I said, okay, raise your hand if you know who those two guys are. And only a couple people raised their hands. I said, okay, if you've got your hands raised, keep them up. And I said, stand up if you're not from the United States. Everybody who had their hands raised stood up. And those guys were looking around totally stunned, because to them, not knowing who Robbie Williams or David Beckham are, that's like saying, do you know who George Bush is? And people shaking their head going, George who?
Right, right.
Okay. So it's really interesting. I call this the myth of everyone, because people say, well, everyone knows that this is the case. or everyone has experienced, or everyone has seen, I got to tell you, the world is way, way bigger than any of us have a first clue of. In the internet marketing circle, I would say that most of the people in the internet marketing world know my name. But if I were to walk down the street to some average Joe and say, hey, I'm Mark Joyner, he's going to look at me and say, Mark who?
That's right. They're going to say, so what?
So what? Yeah, you know, I'm Dave Sassafras. Kiss my butt, right? So he's operating in a totally different world. And that's what we all have to realize, is that our worlds are unique. And sometimes we operate under the assumption that everyone knows our world, and we don't realize that the market is just way, way bigger than we know. Some people will say, man, that market is saturated. And I would have to say that the term marketing saturation is a total myth, right?
Yeah.
Unless you're dealing with a product that has a clearly definable, quantifiable, finite user base, you could never say the market is saturated. Really, that's just an excuse for saying I've run out of marketing ideas.
Well, I'm sure you've heard this all the time, selling to people who want to learn internet marketing. I've heard it all the time that it's a small niche market.
It is, actually. This particular group, right, there's like a direct marketing-oriented group of internet marketers. Mm-hmm. There's like a web-based group of internet marketers that doesn't even hang out with those other guys. Why? Because they think that those guys at the direct marketing seminars, and then I don't want to mention names, they think that they're scummy used car salesmen. They don't associate themselves with them. So you've got more of like the button-down corporate guys, and then you've got sort of like the geeky web marketing guys who are more focused on web design and technology and that kind of stuff. And rarely do those groups meet. But I would venture to say maybe there are groups of people out there who want to learn about internet marketing that I haven't even thought of that are bigger than that. So we have to define which one we're talking about. But that direct marketing-focused internet marketing group is relatively small, and I would have to say that the number of people who want to learn about marketing is a way bigger number than that small group of people.
Can you think of a couple stories of some mega successes with ebooks of people who have created ebooks and just sold tons of them? Just wild success story. Any one or two that stick out in your mind?
Well, gosh, one from just last night. My friend Joe Vitale, who is actually a dear friend of mine. Back then, we barely knew each other. And again, I had to twist Joe's arm to do ebooks at all. By the way, he was making a very intelligent choice because he was sticking with what he knew worked. He didn't want to waste his time with something new just because it's some newfangled thing. That's something that makes a lot of people fail, is that they try every new deal. So it was a very intelligent move on his part not to mess with ebooks until he could see something demonstrable. But the reason I bring this up, it's interesting because just today I get an email from Joe talking about this new ebook that he created. It took him a day to create it, sold it for $19 a pop, and then made $3,000. This isn't a huge amount of money, but they put about maybe 2-3 hours of work into this whole thing. Made about $3,000 in the first few hours of sending out an email about it. Now, that's not a huge success in terms of money, but it demonstrates the massive potential of ebook marketing and how easy it is once you really get the ropes down and once you have a market defined to make money with it.
I interviewed Joe a couple years ago, and I remember in the interview him telling the same story about you, because you reminded me of it. I wouldn't have been able to remember it if you didn't bring it up, but I think he talks about the same story on the interview on my site. Back then, how did you structure that deal? Why even approach him if you had the ability to create your own information products? What was the strategy behind that?
Well, that's a really good question, and I don't think anyone has asked me that yet. And I'll tell you some things that are a little more subtle than I think most guys will get. I like to structure my deals very generously. I wanted to structure it in such a way that he was making a greater percentage than he would from a print book. That was one of the main hooks I went to these guys with. I said, look, you don't have to do any work. You don't have to believe it. We're going to just know that for every unit we sell, and we're not sending this out to distributors, we're the point of sale and the publisher and the manufacturer. We're everything. One-stop shopping. We will give you a percentage of every unit sold that is much greater than you're getting from your print publishers.
Did these have to be books that he was self-publishing? Because I know he was under contract with a publisher. Or could he take the books that he had contract with his publisher and digitize those and do something with you?
Well, it's funny you ask that, because back then the concept of electronic rights didn't even exist. I work with John Wiley & Sons now for my books. They're one of the big three New York publishing houses and just a wonderful company, and I love those guys. But now the contracts that they have got a little section in there. It's, of course, I can't talk about the specifics, but they say electronic rights. Who's got the electronic rights? Well, how does that work? Back then, because it was a gray area, I knew that I wanted to pick something that wouldn't be an issue. He had like a couple of copies of this old hypnotic writing manuscript lying around, and I paid him money for one, and I said, look, this is out of print. You were self-publishing it. Let me convert this into something electronic, because I knew that there wouldn't be an issue. And then we moved on to other things that were a little more complicated. But I didn't want to ask him to do this with a book that had been done by a print publisher at the time, because, again, these things hadn't been defined, and I didn't want to put anybody in any legal hot water. So now, basically what I did is I was just looking for opportunities. I was saying, hey, here's a proven asset. This is something that I think is a really good product myself. I really, really like this myself. I wanted to leverage this. One of the real benefits of doing this, the way you asked it, a deeper answer, you said, why do this when you can do your own stuff? And one of the real benefits, besides the fact that it's leveraging time, I didn't have to do much to actually get it out there, considering the fact that the book had already been written. That was one important thing. But there was actually a subtler and more important benefit, and that was that I was able to raise the level of my own brand by associating myself with guys who were revered in different circles. Further, I was able to cross over between two totally different worlds and tap several different markets at once. Okay, most of the online marketing people had no clue of who Joe Vitale was, or, for example, Ted Nicholas or Joe Sugarman, some of the guys that I was working with later. But when they found out who these guys were and thought, wow, these are guys who in the direct marketing world were so successful, who have done things like produce infomercials. For those of us on the internet at the time, we thought, infomercial, wow, you got to have really a lot of money to produce an infomercial. And it was very, very impressive. So I found guys like that to raise my perception with the internet marketing world. And then also, because there were people who were familiar with the Joe Sugarmans and the Ted Nicholases and the Gary Halberts and all those guys, they would be searching for that, and then I could bring them into my world. So I was bringing customer bases that had existed before into my customer base now, and I was also simultaneously raising the level of my brand. And as you see, there's a number of huge benefits that came as a result.
Who were some of the other people you were working with? You had Joe Vitale. Did you approach Ted Nicholas to digitize some of his hard copy stuff?
I did approach Ted Nicholas as well. Ted had a book that I just absolutely loved called Magic Words That Will Bring You Riches.
Sure.
You probably know it.
Yeah.
What a brilliant book. It wasn't complicated, but every little chapter was a pure gold nugget of wisdom, and it was marketed so brilliantly well. And I knew that he had a great sales letter that he used to promote that book, so I specifically approached Ted about that particular book. I said, Ted, it's such a great book, and I know that you've got a great letter for it. Here's the deal. And I gave him the normal spiel, which was, you know, hey, you're going to get a cut that's greater than what you would have made even if you had published it yourself, because you could charge more for an electronic book, and the margins are so much better. It was all totally hands-off for him. And he, of course, accepted it instantly. Ted Nicholas is just an amazing guy. He's a wonderful human being. Almost all of these direct marketing guys that I worked with are just absolutely wonderful. Now, Ted also came out with a product that we digitized for him as well. It was how it sold over $400 million in products and services. He admitted to me privately that it would actually probably be more like $1 billion, but that seemed like such a huge number that we didn't want to use it. And what it was a compilation of all of his ads, and he would rank them all with stars. He gave them between 1 and 5 stars based on their response. And if it was a 5-star ad, it was one that had an absolutely stellar response rate. I thought, what an amazing resource. And we took that. Here he is, one of the best copywriters in the history of the world. And he has basically broken out almost every one of his ads and ranked it by how well it performed. I don't think you can think of a better tool to learn direct marketing from. That's just an absolute goldmine. We took that and we digitized that as well, and that was a great success.
So when you approach him, do you ask for an exclusive on the digital rights to these products that you're going to promote? You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com.
I did try that, actually, in most cases, and usually guys would do it. Now that the landscape has changed quite a bit, I don't know how many people would give exclusives. But back then, because it was a pioneering effort that we were involved in, I said, look, give us the exclusive, because one really important thing for them is that we were creating their presence on the Internet. Most of these guys weren't known on the Internet at all, and we were creating that presence for them out of thin air. I mean, you can talk to a lot of these old guys, and they'll come back and say, look, it was the experience we had with ESOP that put us on the map on the Internet. And that was why we'd ask for exclusives on those products, because we thought, look, we're putting a tremendous amount of effort into branding you and building up a base for you. We think that that's a good way of getting paid back. And most of the guys would see that, and then they would accept it.
Did you try and negotiate any back end, or it was just you made the money from promoting the book, and that was it? Any back end stuff was theirs to keep, or did you divvy up the names?
We'd get the names, and they wouldn't. Back end they would get would be if somebody was reading the book and then going to visit them from the back of the book. That was all theirs, and we let them keep that because we thought it was fair. If we're the point of sale, we'll keep the name. For example, if you sell your print book in a shop, the author doesn't get the name of everybody who purchased that book. It's just not fair to do that, right? Because these are the guys who busted their tail to make the sale. But inside the book, the author gets usually promote a little bit of his own stuff. If he's smart, that's all his. So that's kind of the way we broke that same deal out. And the majority of the back end for us was we were doing some really innovative stuff that a lot of people are now catching on to. You know, the thank you page of an e-book for a service that we were offering, give them a free month. A lot of people are using that now, calling it one-time offers. It was amazingly effective. When I first figured out that we could do that, I was actually reading something Joe Sugarman wrote, or it was a conversation with Joe. I can't remember what it was. And I just remember Joe talking about how he was using upsells and cross-sells with their call center. And it just clicked with me. I thought, wow, God, why aren't we doing this online? And immediately we set up this test, and we got this thank you page up to a point where like just about 50% of the people who were buying electronic books from us were taking a free month of this service that we were offering. And then the real thing clicked in my head that was probably one of the major catalysts for really taking our company to the next level. And it was the beginning of a new marketing phrase that I created called integration marketing. And it's all about integrating your offer into the existing sales process of someone else. And we could even talk about how Microsoft was really ultimately leveraged by using integration marketing. But anyway, the point is, when I realized that we could do that on the back end of our own sales, I said, wow, what if we go talk to the people who are also now selling electronic books on the Internet or selling Internet marketing-related products, and we do the same thing on their thank you page. And I'll just give them a little demonstration. Look, unused real estate. I've got this tested process here. Here's how I can pull out between $10,000 and $100,000 of new profit for you annually just by slapping this code on your thank you page. And when I had this thought, I literally could not sleep that entire night. I was so excited about it. And I went in the next day and started just bulldozing and getting this to work. There was a tremendous amount of resistance we had to overcome to get it to work. But when we did, I got to tell you, that was one of the most significant events that happened in our company, because from that point forward, we literally tapped into warm markets all over the place without having to pay for the normal front-end acquisition cost of getting these people. And by the way, our acquisition costs, for the most part, weren't dollars, because almost everything we did was $0 advertising. Our acquisition cost was technological. It was time and energy that we were investing. But with this tactic, we didn't have to invest that same kind of time and energy. And we had a wonderful stream of new customers coming in all of the time that weren't as difficult to close. It was just huge for us.
All right, just so I'm clear, I just want to digress a little bit. So back then, your strategy was bringing offline to online. You'd approach marketers like Joe Vitale, Ted Nicholas. They had intellectual property, which was proven in the offline world, and that was a great leverage for you. You had names, probably from your search engine. You had names to get an offer out to, so it was a perfect match. And you would promote these proven offline systems to your names and profit from that, right?
That was one of our uber strategies. We were a rather complicated company that had a lot going on. But yeah, that was one of our core strategies for sure.
When you realized that you could generate more revenue just through this upsell or cross-sell strategy on the thank you page, were you approaching other companies who were selling digital products, and what were you selling them, the code or the system that would allow them to do what you had done?
Yes, great question. And we were approaching other companies, but instead of selling them the code, what we would do is we would tell them, look, you can be an affiliate for what we're selling on the back end here. In every sale that we generate, you're going to be generating revenue. Now, it was a monthly subscription service, and these guys would get monthly revenue as a result of the new people that they were bringing into that. And at the time, people weren't really big on selling subscriptions to services like that. It just hadn't been done. So the lure of it was absolutely massive. It was, oh, wow, hey, all I got to do is get 1,000 of these guys and I can basically retire. That was the way people were thinking about it. Of course, it doesn't quite work like that. It was erroneous to make those kinds of assumptions. But that was sort of the lure.
Can you give me like a specific example of how that worked? Give me an example of maybe someone you approach and what the deal was, basically, so I can understand it.
So let's say the service was $17 a month, which that particular service was.
Is this a service you're selling?
The service we were selling.
What's the service you're selling?
That service back then was a company called ROIBot, which was the first ad tracking company on the Internet. Back then, there weren't any companies offering services to track your advertising. We were the first to do it. And when we came out with it, it was great because people thought, wow, finally, I can start to actually see how effective my ads are, which was great. When we came up with that strategy, we had affiliates who were promoting this for us already, but we would say, look, you get the same affiliate deal. Every month, you'll get $4 for every subscriber you bring in. And now, what we do is we put this upsell where the purchaser of the product gets the first month of ROIBot for free. And then if they continue on, we build their credit card. So it was really wonderful because guys would look at that and they'd say, oh, hey, I'm not doing anything with my thank you page here. I should be marketing something, but I'm not. And we would just do a little bit of math together. I'd say, let's assume conservatively that only 20% of the guys actually take you up on the offer and then continue on with the service. How many sales are you getting a day? Of course, they're going to trump up the number of sales that they tell you, but you use that as your math, calculate it out, and you say, okay, well, by your math, let's cut that in half. Let's just use some fudge factor and cut that in half. By your math and cutting it totally in half, it's looking like you're going to get many more dollars a month revenue. And I would say by the end of the year, that will be this much. And then, of course, we talk about how that would grow as they brought more and more people in.
Let's move on to another question from Eduardo Duran. Mark, what type of information at this moment or time do people find valuable in today's society? In a note, I had multiple people ask me the same question in one form or another.
Oh, that's a great, great question. I would say that that's something that's fluid and changing at all times. If I give you an answer for that right now, like what's happening in this moment, it's not going to be meaningful even a few months from now. Look for trends. Go out there and go to WordTracker and buy their report of the most searched for keywords. Look at Google Zeitgeist. There are a lot of ways out there to keep track of what people are looking for, what people are interested in. Look in the news. Find out what are people talking about in the news right now. For example, as this interview is being recorded, one of the big concerns is bird flu. Hey, people are concerned about that. What if you wrote a report about the reality of that? Is there anything that your family has to worry about? How could you protect yourself? As long as it's done properly and it's not some kind of slimy profiteering over fear, which I think is something that is really despicable. Unfortunately, we've got marketers who do that kind of thing. But as long as it's not something like that, as long as it's real, valuable content, and as long as it's respectful and accurate and good, well, then really the world's your oyster. There's so many opportunities out there.
This is the end of part one with Mark Joyner. Please continue to part two. For more interviews like this, please go to hardtofindseminars.com.